Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 15th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Bradley Hansen. Today's session is number 998 and is titled Spirituality and Church Traditions. Let's listen in.
And this is number 8, I think, in a series on Lutheran spirituality. And I'll talk about some characteristics. What I've done is identify some characteristics of Lutheran spirituality, and that while a number of these characteristics would be shared by other Christian traditions, I think the combination of them is peculiar to the distinctive of the Lutheran tradition. And so, maybe just to review those quickly, there is a very serious interpretation of the human condition that we are. I mean, for instance, you find this being expressed in the confession of sin: we are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. You see, not all Christian traditions say something like that. It's not only Lutherans that would affirm that, but it distinguishes us from some others. The emphasis upon justification by grace, which I think in terms of spiritual life means to, it isn't just a doctrine, but it's a matter of living, and that's living with trust in God's merciful grace in all realms of life. And the emphasis there, again, all Christian traditions have an emphasis upon grace in one way or other, but there's different ways of understanding grace. Some traditions, there's two main elements in understanding of grace. One is the element of transformation, changing, making a person more holy, you might say, more like Christ. The other dimension of grace is the grace that that accepts, that forgives. The Lutheran tradition, I think, is unique in its understanding of grace, is that the primary emphasis falls upon that acceptance dimension, that forgiveness or acceptance dimension. I think every other Christian tradition, the primary emphasis falls upon the transformation. The third characteristic here, I think, is that in the Lutheran tradition, is that there's a primary emphasis upon the word coming to us through words, whether it's in proclamation or scripture, music. But as the primary way that God's grace comes to us, that we encounter and know about that grace, experience it, is through words. In that respect, we are like other Protestant traditions, I think. On the other hand, and that would distinguish us from Lutherans, say, from the Roman Catholic tradition, which is where the primary means of grace is sacraments, right? On the other hand, for Lutherans, there is considerable emphasis and importance given to sacraments as well as to other physical symbols. That would distinguish us, on the one hand, from some other, many other Protestant traditions here. For instance, Protestant traditions that are kind of further up on the scale, so to speak, would have, there's less emphasis given to sacraments than in the Lutheran tradition, less emphasis also given to physical symbols generally, so that if, for instance, if you go into a congregational church in the Reformed tradition or say a Baptist church, you're likely to encounter a church sanctuary which has, which is relatively barren, not many symbols there. Whereas if you go into an Orthodox church, of course, you have an abundance of physical symbols. And there's a correlation, I think, there between the emphasis and the understanding given to sacraments and also the prominence given to physical symbols generally. Well, in that regard, the Lutherans and the Anglicans or Episcopalians, I think, are kind of in the middle in that, on that score. Fifth characteristic of Lutheran spirituality that I've distinguished is that in emphasis, this is a communal spirituality. It's not so many folks are into spirituality because they think of it as something primarily about me. I think this is very definitely a communal spirituality. but it is an understanding of the church also, not so much as having a definite certain structure, which it ought to have, as would be the case, say, for the Episcopal tradition or the Roman Catholic tradition, both of which understand a certain structure, bishops in one case and bishops and papacy in the other case, as being essential, really kind of to the fullness of the church. In the Lutheran tradition, there's a primary emphasis there upon the church's community of believers, without necessarily specifying a particular kind of structure, and also an emphasis there upon nurturing of one another, kind of the priesthood of all believers. And then yesterday you dealt with the topic of our view towards the Lutheran stance towards church traditions, that there's this kind of rough distinction, I think, between core church traditions, like we were mentioning here, the doctrine of the Trinity, justification by faith, that belong to that core, and yet in the matters of secondary traditions, there's a respect for them, for time-honored practices, but also a matter of freedom toward them. And so in regard to worship, I think worship practices, there is that freedom. Now, today we are here at number 7, talking about conviction that God's twofold rule summons all people to seek justice and calls Christians to faithful service in daily relationships. Many people, when they use the word spirituality, understand spirituality as being very kind of religious, and particularly emphasizing certain religious practices that nurture a person's faith, that build it up and strengthen it. And certainly I think that is true. There is no universally accepted definition of spirituality. But in my understanding of spirituality, if I had another board here, I would write on it, but I don't want to flip this over and come back. My understanding of spirituality is that a spirituality is equals a faith plus a path. And that, in other words, it's a faith that is both nurtured by certain practices, but also expressed in certain practices. And what we've been emphasizing up to this point, kind of looking at, is the ways in which this faith of trusting in God's merciful grace, that kind of a relationship with God, is nurtured through words, through sacraments, through community life, through attention to certain traditions. Now we're emphasizing today, how is that faith expressed in daily life, in the world? And so that's our subject for the day, you see. So my understanding of spirituality is that it's not just a kind of hothouse kind of thing, that you go aside to do that, but spirituality is something that pervades one's entire life, and hence it includes this element of carrying over into one's daily life. So that's the subject for today. And how a person's faith gets expressed in his or her life is going to be affected to a great extent by the vision of how God is related to daily life. There is a kind of underlying vision or underlying theology, you might say, that is implicit and sometimes explicit. For example, there have been some Christians who have emphasized that a certain form of spirituality involved celibacy and voluntary poverty and a kind of stable community life apart. In other words, living in a sort of religious or monastic community, that has been one way to understand spirituality. Well,
and so there's and there's a certain understanding of how God is related to the world that lies behind that. In the Lutheran tradition, it's been a tradition which has always emphasized it as a spirituality that is kind of lived out in ordinary life. And behind that also is a certain understanding of how God is related to everyday life. And that understanding is one that has been traditionally called the two kingdoms of God, or we can talk about it as God's twofold rule. So I'll talk a little bit about this, and then in two stages. And so the first stage will, and then I'll pause for see what kind of comments and observations you may have or questions. First of all, there is sort of God's rule over the whole world as creator and sustainer of the world. It means that God is not just. So often we think of God as creator, we think of God as being active way back then. But actually, it's a continuous creativity of God, and that continuous creativity is one of sustaining life. And that sustenance of life occurs in a variety of ways. It occurs, for example, of course, through nature, providing us with the things that we need, the air to breathe, and the things to eat, etc. But it also happens through people. And Luther's understanding, this comes from Martin Luther, right? And Luther's understanding is that people who fulfill a kind of useful social role are kind of what he calls masks of God. They serve others, and they are kind of means by which God indirectly meets the needs of other people. And whether that's true whether they know it or not. So, for example, you all, I assume, came here on a boat. I came on a boat. I don't think I haven't seen any helicopters around, so I assume that we all got here by boat. All right. Now, on that boat, there was, somebody that took your ticket, right? Sold your ticket, somebody took the ticket and loaded on the luggage. Now, that person, in Luther's understanding, is serving a useful function, you see? Providing a useful service for other people. You want to be able to take a boat, you see? That person is able to help transport you from this place to another place. And so, and that's true, that person is sort of a mask of God and is a medium through which God helps and serves the needs of people. Whether or not that person taking the tickets believes in God or cares a whit about you. As long as the person does his or her job reasonably well, you know, does what is needed, there is a service provided. Similarly, like say if you eat at a restaurant and someone serves the food to you. Someone is a waiter, and as that waiter, the wait person comes and helps you, provides that service to you through the meal, that too is a means by which that person is a means through which God is kind of meeting your need for food. So, and again, whether or not this wait staff person believes in God and whether or not he or she cares a whip about you, maybe doing it just for the wages, right? That's what Luther regards as sort of God's rule through the world as creator. Now, where there's constructive social roles, then helpful kind of social roles, then there are those kind of useful services that are provided. Now we could nuance that further, but we'll see if that may come out in some questions. But then there is also another way that God rules, and that's through the gospel. In other words, it could be, for instance, let's say that person who is the who takes the tickets and helps load the luggage at the boat, that this person comes to believe in Jesus Christ and now has faith in God and sees his or her role as one of, yes, trusting in God and loving his or her neighbor, okay? Now this person is experiences, let's say, her role of taking tickets and loading luggage as a vocation, as a divine calling, you see? A divine calling, that's what the word vocation means, really, is calling. And so there is this sense of my doing this activity of helping people onto the boat and handling their luggage, etc. I understand now that I am serving them, that God calls me to serve them, to provide a useful service. Okay. Now that applies, that whole understanding, that distinction here between the two ways that God rules applies not only to the realm of work, but it applies also, say, to the realm of family life. So you could think about, for instance, that any parent who takes care of his or her child is serving God and serving the child, whether or not the parent believes in God. See, it's a means by which God indirectly takes care of one of the creatures of this world. But it's also possible through the faith in the gospel to experience one's role as a parent as a divine vocation, as a divine calling. That now, and so what happens here then, and there's other realms in life in which you can think of this way as well, but what happens then with this understanding is that daily life, kind of daily relationships, and can be experienced, understood, and invested with divine significance, okay, kind of profound, deep experience or meaning, because now I experience this as being called to God to serve this, that way or the other, okay? Maybe I'll just pause there and see if there's some questions, because there are some interesting questions here about social roles. Not all social roles are constructive. Maybe some social roles are kind of mixed. But let's just see if you have any observations or questions or comments that you want to make at this point. Yeah, Carl?
Well, under the Lutheran interpretation of this, how about the one who receives, the one side or the other side? Is there a difference?
You mean the service?
Oh, that you receive. Okay, sure. That for instance, you could experience your side. That's a good question. As for instance, as you're a, it principally is understood as more rendering of service, but the one who is receiving the service, in a sense. Could be a distinction here between, here, you're just, the person is doing his or her job, and that's okay, that's how you see that person, all right? I'm paying him or her to do this, and that's part of the service that's provided to me, and that's what I deserve. I suppose if you were to understand it, you could understand our role as a vocation, as a person who's sitting in a restaurant, that part of my divine calling is to treat this waitstaff person with respect, to honor, and probably to tip well, too.
Well, I meant more, how does the person who receives benefiting one more than the other, or receiving a spiritual gift from one and not from the other?
Oh, it may or may not be the case. I mean, for instance, the person who's taking your ticket and handling your luggage, there may not be any way that you would distinguish between one and the other.
I think that masks business is helpful there, Brad. Mm-hmm. You talk about the way and you helpfully talked about on the rule over the whole world as creator, that the person who does their work is a mask of God. And we tend to think of mask as something that hides.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in this case, it's something that reveals. So if you have eyes to see, then you will receive that gift of service from someone else as from God.
Okay.
Even though the person who provides that to you may not be aware of it, so that the mask can both hide or reveal. It's,
mm-hmm.
God is invisible to us. The mask makes God present, but doesn't show us everything about God. It's a wonderful concept.
Yeah. No, that is good. Thank you.
But to
is
the receiver, does that help?
Does that help, Carl?
Sure.
Is that answering what you... Good. Thanks, Jan. That's very good. Any other comments, observations, questions?
Pretty hard to see God on this side. If somebody is serving you that doesn't know him or, you know, give two hoots about you as the person that he would be waiting on. I mean, you run into some pretty nasty waiters and waitresses and stuff, and you just want to get out of there quickly.
Well,
so, but God is still active in that, whether they know it or not, but it's pretty hard to feel it or see it.
But it isn't necessarily that the person that's just doing it for the pay is a nasty person or doing their job in a nasty way. They could be doing it, you know.
Well, I know, but I mean, it often happens that they are doing it in a nasty way.
Sure.
Or just, you know, like being bothered that you're there and they have to wait on you, even though they're getting paid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty hard to recognize that God could use that as a way of reaching his people.
Okay.
Through someone like that.
Yeah.
But there's an amount of compassion that you can show, and that would bring out the spirituality of you, even though this person does not portray his own spirituality.
Yeah. Why is this person flustered?
Yeah.
Why is this person, kind of hasty? I mean, quite often, I have a daughter who's done some weighted work over the years in earlier time, and quite often it's not that person's fault. It's somebody hasn't shown up for work, and this person now is, this weight person is having to cover, for another person as well as her own or his own. And so there is that sense of our responsibility as a recipient of that service to have some compassion. That's true. Yeah.
As we'd say, that late person that just sees this as a job, as an occupation, at least God's hand is in the fact that they aren't serving you cyanide with your...
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
But that there's still some good coming to you through that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've all had the experience of some days we go to work and we feel like it really is a vocation, and other days we go to work and we're drained and we just barely drag ourselves during the day, through the day, and know that we're not doing right or doing as well as we would like to and falling short of our own expectations. And we all have those good days and bad days.
Yeah. Having compassion for ourselves as well as for others.
At which point you are saying that spirituality calls us to that, at that moment, to wake up and to realize that God still is at work in us, and so we try them to redirect our efforts, our thoughts.
Yes. And to kind of come back again and again to recognize that yes, I'm called here to serve, and it's difficult. Something, maybe there's parts of the job that I don't like. But maybe those too are instrumental to providing a good service. I mean, for instance, I'm not exactly thrilled about reading a pile of student exams. But I mean that's what I consider kind of the grunt labor of my kind of work. But I mean, it is. If students don't get feedback, I mean, how are they going to learn? You see, that's part of the process that if I could see that that kind of deeper meaning in it, I guess.
then I'm more willing to go through that process, which I don't particularly enjoy so much.
I think that's one of the really important things about the way Luther talks about vocation, in contrast to how that often is talked about in the late 20th century, that vocation is the thing that makes you happy.
Yes.
And I don't think Luther goes so far as because you're miserable, that's a sign that God has called you to do it. But there's some middle ground in which the unpleasant is made possible by this knowledge that God has called you to do this work on behalf of another.
Yeah.
So that, and I think it's really important not to go to that place where, because I hate bugs and I love a hot bath, clearly I'm being called to do missionary work in the jungle, you know. But nonetheless, to know that vocation isn't all about cheeriness. And I think, correct me if this is right, but don't you think Luther is more concerned about how we serve rather than how we are served?
I think so.
In that sort of Franciscan...
Right. And that's what kind of surprised me about Carl's question, in a way, because he was looking at it from how we are served, sort of side, which I think is an interesting kind of question to raise. But you're right, that I think the primary emphasis in Luther's thinking is how we serve rather than how we are recipients of service. Yeah.
So even as the one served, then, we are to pay attention as to how we treat the one serving us.
Yeah, I think so.
That compassion.
Sure.
Concern for the one who might be having a bad day.
I suppose our role in that sense, I mean, you could think of here, we tend to think of here, you know, work and family relationship, but our social role at that time is to be customer. Okay? Now, there can be bad customers, too.
Yeah.
You can get mean, irritable, lousy customers, unappreciative. And so for us to be good customers, courteous, et cetera, appreciative of the services that are rendered, if they are indeed done well. There's another side to this that's kind of interesting, too, and that's the question about these masks of God are kind of social roles, but what about the social role may be one that is a very mixed kind of thing that means, for instance, many of the social roles that have been traditionally assigned for women were of certain kinds, you see, in which constricted them in many ways. And so do you simply, is it to fulfill that social role may be something that it's a mixed blessing. I mean, there are potentialities for good, but perhaps there's some negative signs. Or for myself, say, as a teacher, part of being a teacher in the American system is to get grades. And I'm not one of those people that anguish over giving grades, but I do feel my ideal system would be to be able to reward a student on the basis of his or her work in relationship to his or her ability. I mean, that would be the ideal for me. But I don't know how to do that. And there's no reliable way for me to know what a person's potential is, what their capabilities are, and really how much work they're putting forth. And so, you end up doing it in this kind of system of, you look at final products and what's the various levels of quality here. And I feel that there's a kind of unfairness in that. But it's part of the system in which I'm involved. And to change that would be to change, in some very fundamental way, the entire system. Any thoughts or reflections and observations on that?
I think the concept that life isn't fair is a good one. And just because you're the brunt of life's unfairness doesn't reduce your own self-worth. And we all need to know that so we can function well in a world that isn't fair.
mm-hmm.
and not fall apart.
Yeah.
Things should have gone our way, but don't.
Anything else? Anything else?
I think that the doctrine of vocation, as Luther outlines, it has the potential for a real dynamism against those static categories. And it hasn't always been released. But the potential is there in that we're accountable finally to God for the gifts God has given us in service to others. So the particular social categories are not what's final.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctrine of vocation, unfortunately, especially for women, has often been used to say, well, yeah, it's too bad you can't do such and such, but what you do is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, and I don't want mm-hmm. to denigrate that, and yet to say there's more dynamic possibility to say, well, but if you would serve well in that other role, then maybe you should. And maybe the categories are less important than the gifts and the service needed. But I don't think we've been very, I think we've really let that loose.
No, in the Lutheran tradition, I think with Luther himself, tended to think, and probably people of that age, and I imagine it's part of the assumptions of that time, that tended to think of social roles as something that were much more fixed, that didn't change. And, you know, I think we've, now, given their experience in modern history, there's a very strong sense of change and development, and so that, you know, that we create these social roles in many ways, or at least the specific shape of many of them. So, I think there is that potential for being able to, well, reshape these social roles rather than simply accepting what is there. You know. Yeah, Carl?
As to the grade system that you're talking about,
yes.
It seemed to me like there's a kind of a parallel to life there, too, in that I think we're being graded as to our living up to our potential of our creative purpose.
Mm-hmm. Graded in what way? I mean, would you like to develop that a little bit more?
Well, I think graded from the standpoint of where do you fall in your potential or you're living up to your creative purpose? Are we, aside from we're being saved by grace,
mm-hmm.
there still is grace without works is dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think from a standpoint there is a parallel that between the grading of the scholastic abilities and performance.
Okay. Any thoughts?
That logic really quickly brings us into the trap of doing good works so that we can be saved versus doing good works because we were saved. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real, why do you do the good things? You know, because as I understand, I was not born in the Lutheran Church. I'm married into it, so
mm-hmm.
I'm still learning a lot of, not understanding a lot of things. But as I understand it, we don't do good things in order to make ourselves better and work ourselves up the ladder. We do it as a response of our faith, not the reason for it. And, you know, what you were saying can real easily be twisted the other way to saying, well, we're doing it in order to make our, to earn our way into heaven. And, which isn't going to happen. So that's it. You got to be real careful on that. I was thinking of you when you talked to grades. My wife was talking about last night because Beanie Lundholm, you know, we heard her talking about it. When she went to school at Augustana, took piano lessons from him, got a C, and he said, "You're really doing B work, but you're capable of much better."
Mm-hmm.
So he gave us. But she remembered that she's a music teacher today.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
She. You know, there was a guy who did stretch the envelope a little bit, not just following. But nowadays you have trouble because of the legalistic society we're living in, where if you do that, come and come back and sue you for it because you weren't, you know, give somebody else. And it's,
mm-hmm.
we get ourselves a real
mm-hmm.
problem on some of this
stuff. Well, Well, maybe to respond, any other responses to what was raised here?
Yeah. Well, I think ultimately you have to figure out who's doing the grading, and actually it's yourself that's doing the grading. I mean, it's your own spirituality that you have to become comfortable with, and ultimately figure it out within yourself if you're doing you're on the right course. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's anybody or anything or any entity at this point that can tell you that you are where your grade is. And grading is, I don't think, should even enter into it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I'm in a position in our church right now where we're between pastors. We're looking, you know, so and we've only been doing that for a couple of months, so it's going to be 6 months at least before we find another pastor. And I am one of these people who is not afraid to get up in front of the congregation, so I've sort of become semi-permanent liturgist, helping the supply pastors. Now, when we're on vacation or something, they do somebody else. As soon as I'm back, I've got the job again. Very honestly, I'm getting tired of it. But people say I do a good job at it. We, you know, keep it up. So I'm doing it not necessarily because I want to, but it seems to be helping a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm being graded by the congregation is doing better. Now, I'm glad some other people are doing it, but it's not my internal grading that's doing it. Other people are, but I'm willing, I'll do it. My wife says, well, you enjoy it? Yeah, to a point, but, you know, what was it? Somebody said if Mark Pointerson, if it wasn't for the honor considered, I'd just assume not be ridden out of town on the rail or whatever it was, you know. So other people do grade you, and you have to respond to that. And part of this, when you're saying the doing things, I think sometimes if we do something well, whether we really enjoy it or not, if it is benefiting enough other people, the overbalance of how much it benefits them and they're getting out of it versus what I don't like out of it, sometimes the good versus the larger group versus the individual.
Yes, dear.
What this man just said is helpful to me in this regard, because certainly it's the case, even if we are saved by grace, that we continue to be evaluated. I sing badly. People don't ask me to do things that require singing. But what happens is that the ultimate currency of the evaluation is different. It's always Bonhoeffer uses the distinction between ultimate and penultimate. It's always penultimate. It's only about my singing. It's not about anything else. And in fact, when I give grades, I have this long speech I give in class about what these grades don't mean. Mm-hmm. They, you know, so you get an F, it doesn't mean nobody's ever going to want to be your roommate. You get an A, it doesn't, you know, to be really clear about this is an evaluation of this piece of work. It's not an evaluation of you. And that's a dangerous distinction between work and you, but because there's some relationship, but evaluation isn't always ultimate. Mm-hmm. It's usually penultimate. It's limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you think about when we come down at the end, I'm thinking, reminding here of the kind of daily dynamic of dying and rising with Christ, too. Kind of remembering our baptism. And that is a dying and rising with Christ. And that each day, as we come down, that we have the sense that perhaps, yes, we have maybe done some good that day, but it's also been a mixed bag. That we never get that kind of perfect day, so that we're aware, I think, on ourselves and of it to some extent that yes, that we haven't measured up, and so there is that. But at the same time, there is that kind of acceptance of God that we're still loved as a daughter or son of God, even though we have not measured up in all those ways. And so then it's a call each day to renewed service. What, in fact, it seems to me that whole business about grace even goes deeper than that, because
Our sin is not just a matter of what we are aware of doing or not doing, but there's also a lot of which we are not conscious, of which we are not aware. And I think, we'll come to, when we face the Lord, that we'll say, oh, goodness sakes, there are things that which we are simply, to which we are simply blind at this point in our life. But that we don't need to be terrified by that, I think. We shouldn't be lulled to, laziness about it, but we need not be terrified by it because God accepts us even though we have all those limitations. So there is that. I think there's that fuels, I think, each day a kind of desire to serve because it is fueled by this relationship of trust in God, trust in a loving God. You want to serve such a God and who's all of who's, and then that helps us be aware of other people also as sons and daughters of God. The more that we become, I think the deeper our faith in God becomes, the deeper our relationship with God, the deeper sense that we have of other people as being children of God. And therefore, we're more inclined to be respectful, to be kind, to be considerate, and so on, and to do our very best.
An example of singing reminds me of a story I heard a man tell not too long ago. When he was a little boy, he really liked to sing. He would sing quite loud. He'd go to church with his parents. He just loved to sing these songs. And he was singing kind of loudly one day, and his mother kind of nudged him in church and told him not to sing quite that loudly. And afterward he asked why, and the point was he couldn't sing very well. He was kind of off key, and he should sing quietly. So he began to sing quietly, and less and less, until finally he wasn't singing at all. And he grew up thinking he could not sing, that he couldn't carry a tune, that he didn't have that gift. He got to college, though, and he had some friends that sang in quartets, and he wanted to learn how to sing. So he took voice lessons, and he did learn how to sing. He learned how to carry a tune. He learned about pitch so that he could get up and sing with groups. It was a gift. He said he doesn't have a wonderful voice, but he sang for us. And did a fine job.
Mm-hmm.
If we say that God, the spiritual world through the gospel, is gifting us, is giving to us, and I think the Bible quite plainly says we all have different gifts and abilities, and we don't all have the same thing. But if we believe that God definitely is working in us, then the potential is almost there. Who knows? Maybe next year. Maybe
well,
next year.
Our choir director used to say that. It's understood by me enough now. He stopped saying it. But I still sing.
But with anything.
Yeah.
God is not quite, I hope that's God right. Isn't quite finished gifting me yet.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not all done living. So who knows what will be next. And that kind of puts a different slant on things as far as grading also. Because ultimately, the one who grades also is the one who gives us the ability in the first place. I shouldn't say, well, I don't have this, therefore I can't, and I won't, and I'm not any good at. That's God's responsibility also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, if it's all right, unless somebody else has something they want to add at this point, I'll shift gears into another topic. We've talked about God's twofold rule, principally in respect to kind of family life and work. We've actually been concentrating more on work. Another whole arena, the arena of what we might call public life, or common life, where we're dealing with, say, with politics, with economics. Whereas when we think about family life and work, we tend to think more, it's sort of everyday, kind of close to home
when we're talking about public theology, public life, it's kind of more broad scale. And in this regard, the Lutheran theology in this two kingdom interpretation has been one that there's considerable debate, let me put it that way, today about it, all right? Maybe what we could do is, there was a classic book by H. Richard Niebuhr that talks about different ways of relating Christ and culture. And you could, it's kind of nice because it gives you a feel for maybe how the Lutheran stance here in dealing with public life fits in relationship to some others. He talks about first as being Christ against culture. And for example, an example there would be the Amish. We have in my home community, very close by us, a number of Amish, where there's a strong sense of there's a quite a clash, you might say, between being a Christian and the larger culture. And so the Amish kind of will not participate in holding public office, for example, you see, because they feel that there's quite a clash there. A second option is to talk about the Christ of culture. And this takes the form in which there is a kind of accommodation of Christian faith to the prevailing culture. And that can be take either liberal or conservative forms. But it seems like there's a kind of smooth, easy relationship between what the culture believes and holds and Christian faith. And then Christ and culture in synthesis has been the kind of classic Roman Catholic approach, where there's an effort to kind of work out a kind of some sort of synthesis of whatever the culture is and Christian faith. A fourth one has been Christ transforming or converting, transforming culture. This has been what has particularly been prominent in the Reformed tradition, where it's an effort to create, in some cases, some of the New England colonies were sort of like theocracies, where you sought to kind of merge together to create a culture that was very much informed profoundly and thoroughly by Christian faith. And that has been kind of more the predominant strain in American public life and public theology. The Lutheran way has been Christ in culture in paradox, or a kind of dialectic, or intention maybe would be another way to put it. There is the sense there that there is an uneasy relationship between the various elements in the culture and Christian faith. There are elements to be affirmed, but there's also elements, for instance, that need to be criticized. And this is true whatever the social movement is. So, for instance, there are times in which there is a new social movement, let's say, it right now it could be the ecological movement. There are some folks that would tend to say, well, that's kind of going to be our savior. Now, someone who comes from this Christ and culture and paradox, a kind of Lutheran read of that, will say, well, no, come on now, let's not, this is something that there's a lot of good in this, we can affirm this, that, and the other thing, but perhaps there are some other aspects that we need to have some questions about. You see, that's a kind of this sort of dialectical, paradoxical relationship to culture. Now, there has been a debate, as I mentioned, in Lutheran circles about this public theology. What happened is that for several centuries, Lutherans tended to sort of operate as though their Christian faith was over here and what went on in the public arena was over here, as though they were separate. All right? And now, in the last 30 years, well, the last 40 years since World War II, I think Lutherans, both in you know, in this country and other countries, have worked much more at seeing them in kind of conversation with one another. And yet, there are some differences that appear. And I'll just show you. I'll give you an example of the differences here using a two statements on capital punishment, all right? The first of these statements is Lutheran Church Missouri Synod statement, which says that it affirms very strongly the right of the state to be able to have capital punishment. Now it recognizes, goes on to recognize that sometimes the capital punishment is not uniformly applied, so far as like race and gender, you know, social class. But it, on the whole, it tends to say, well, those, yes, are important kind of consideration, but it tends to come back to say, capital punishment is a viable option. It is something that the state has the right to do, even though Christians may have an objection to whether it ought to be applied in this case or that case. Okay. Now, that whereas the ELCA also came out with a statement a few years later on capital punishment, in which it took quite a different stand. It argued against capital punishment. The vote was, I think, something like 3/4 of the churchwide assembly was against. Now, why? What were the arguments being used there? The arguments were that that it wasn't applied. It recognized, yes, that this has something that there is some possibility for thinking about this, but said, no, we should really, this should be not used, capital punishment, because it is unjustly applied. I mean, certain social groups, if you're poor, you tend to, if you're black, for example, you tend to be higher percentages of this. So it's not fairly applied. Furthermore, the argument is given that Christians should be informed by, or the society, here I'll quote it from, I'll quote you the actual words here, give you the feel for this now. Lutheran theological tradition has maintained that society is ruled by the law and is influenced and nourished by the gospel. Renewed by the gospel, Christians are salt of the earth, and here's a reference made, in light of the world, are called to respond to violent crime in the restorative way taught by Jesus. The restorative way taught by Jesus. Reference here to Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, turn the other cheek, and are shown by his actions. Now, what's going on here? It's a different kind of approach. It's saying that Christians should think much more imaginatively, you might say, about being fueled with possibilities from the gospel and like Jesus' nonviolence, that Christians should be willing and to suggest to the larger society to follow ways that would be informed by that gospel. And so on the question about capital punishment, they say we should, rather than following the kind of eye for an eye sort of justice, we should follow the pattern of restorative justice in which we seek to rebuild people's lives. Well, maybe I'll just pause there. There's more I could say, but maybe that's enough to kind of kick off how there's differences here. These are both Lutheran groups. they're both working in some sense with the two kingdoms kind of interpretation, but there's different reads of it, different interpretations of it, different twists. Yeah.
Did they consider the idea of that if you, in other words, salvation or saving of souls, main purpose of the church, if you execute someone and he hasn't accepted the Lord, and you cut him off from the possibility that if, for example, he had life imprisonment or something, that he could have accepted it during his lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and therefore you condemned him to hell.
Okay, it wasn't expressed quite that way, but I suppose this latter judgment is one where it's talking about this restorative justice that you seek to rebuild people's lives, whereas what we have done, most our legal system is set up on what is called retributive justice. That is to say, if someone causes harm to someone else, the person who's done the harm should have to suffer some sort of balancing penalty. And of course, with capital punishment, then it's a kind of a life for a life kind of balance. And so the latter, the ALCA statement, is saying, no, we should seek to try to provide opportunities for people's lives to be, and not just the one who has committed the murder, but the victims, the families, you know, the families of the person who's been killed, let's say, that to work with them as well in a restorative way.
In the same vein, there's an example. I don't know what's happening with the case right now. I can't think of the woman's name. Sibianese liberation. What's her name?
Sarah Jane Olson.
Sarah Jane Olson, yeah. She was discovered 20, well...
Oh, yes, 20, yes.
20 years later.
Yes, yes.
Went extradited to California to seek to face trial.
Yes.
Because she has to be punished.
Yeah.
For her crimes.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, if you look at her life and what's happened to her life, you know, there's been rehabilitation. She's been restored. So,
yeah.
To me, that case also deals with the same tension that you're talking about here.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I would come down to the point and say, well, what can be served by spending money, wasting time, destroying mm-hmm. life
mm-hmm.
when she's been restored?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's already happened.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe no one else knows what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the counter to that is that
let's hear the counter.
And some would say that that's a put on, but if you can put on this act, well, then you can get away with it. Mm-hmm. But the Old Testament says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but then Jesus said, you heard it said, an eye for an eye.
Mm-hmm.
But I say unto you, turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
Well, I have some good friends who are members of the congregation where she is a member.
Oh, yeah.
They're talking about the turmoil and the disbelief that all that's been happening, because they know her personally,
mm-hmm.
And have known her for years.
It was like that gallon.
And it's not a put on, in their opinion.
It was like that gal in Texas that so many had come.
Yes.
And she had, well, the ones that still wanted her to be executed, really said, well, she's just put on.
Yes, you remember this case? It's maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
A woman who, as a young woman, maybe she was on drugs, and I think she was involved in killing a couple people. I mean, a very brutal murder. It was just terrible. But then later, when she was in prison, you know, in death row for some years, she became a Christian, and so there was appeals to have her sentence remitted, but it wasn't done. But when she died, when she was in the execution room, as I recall, she said something about, I love you all, or something like that, and expressed forgiveness towards those who were doing it. And, So it wasn't, you know, it doesn't appear like it was put on at all.
But this is the argument.
Yeah, that's the argument, sure. Well, in any case, the whole...
And Paul would say that the emperor there, or the government, is just doing their job.
That's right. That's right.
They're following their occupation.
Yep.
And that God's working through the world for the good of all of us,
mm-hmm.
to keep
mm-hmm.
peace. So we should just be quiet then.
Yeah. And that's the more kind of your gospel sort of is over here and your law is over here, and I think that at least a number of folks are saying that we shouldn't have such a wide divide, that we should let some of those thoughts and inspirations from the gospel feed into our public life as well. And this whole issue about capital punishment is just kind of one example of that. There'd be others.
I just heard George Farrell speak last week, and his point, any law that's punitive is no good.
Is that right?
What's the point?
Uh-huh. Oh.
They should all be restorative.
I see. Okay.
If they aren't, throw them off.
Okay. Yeah. Well, our time is up, so thank you very much. For